Well, it may be cheesy, but we had to start the show with a theme tune, and what better way to start than one of the best tracks on one of the greatest albums ever made, the way we all used to test our stereo systems back in the day, eh, Paul?
Exactly, yeah. Who'd have thought of it, money?
Indeed. Pink Floyd. I think we both came to the same conclusion. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Simon Webster, and welcome to the second edition of Money Talk. For those of you who missed our inaugural episode, I am an independent financial advisor based in Ashford with my wife Pam, who's also my business partner. We've worked together for 20 years. I'm here in the studio down here at Channel Radio with Paul Andrews, who's here to make sure that I push the right buttons at the right time. He goes by the title of producer, which is fantastic. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Simon. How are you?
I'm extraordinarily well, and I'm struck by the fact that every time I come down here, the sun is shining. Have you arranged something?
Absolutely. It's all part of the service. Channel Radio shows only happen in the sunshine. Even in the heart of, in the depths of winter, we have sunshine on a radio day.
I will bear that in mind. People, you heard it here. It is sunny in Dimchurch in the wintertime. Well, we'll get there in due course and find out if he's true. Somebody told me a joke this week, which I thought was absolutely fantastic, so I'm going to include this because it was about Paul.
Oh, really?
Mr. Smith was on his deathbed and came up with a plan to take some of his wealth with him. He calls for the three men in his life that he trusts the most: Paul Andrews, his best mate, his doctor, and his local vicar. "I'm going to give you each £30,000 in cash before I die," says Mr. Smith, "and at my funeral, I want you each to place the money in my coffin so that I can take it with me." At the funeral, each approaches the coffin and places an envelope inside. Later, while riding in the limo to the cemetery, the vicar says, "I have to confess, I only put 20 grand in the coffin. The church needs a new roof very badly, so I took £10,000 out of the envelope." The doctor said, "Well, I didn't put the full £30,000 in the coffin either. I used £20,000 of the money to pay off, to pay off my gambling debts." Paul then said, "I'm ashamed of you both. When I put my envelope in that coffin, it held my personal cheque for the full sum of £30,000.
Yeah.
My thanks to a good friend, Brian Kelly, on Facebook this morning for that one, but I did rather like that. It just struck me that that was a good place to start. But let's turn to financial news. The big story of the morning is that the presidents of Russia and Ukraine seem to have finally brokered a peace deal. Now, people may wonder, what on earth has what's happening in Ukraine got to do with UK finances? But what you've got to ask yourself is, where does all our gas come from? And if there's problems in that region, then there could be some real issues for gas prices, which will impact on the back pockets of every single person in the land.
I see what you mean. When you first said that, I thought I knew where my gas came from, because I just devoured a Diet Pepsi, but I see what you...
Well, Russia's looking pleased because they restored some of its former glory by a bit of sabre-rattling in its geographical area of influence, and Ukraine has gone some way to restoring its territorial integrity. There's a 14-point plan, apparently. It's early days yet. We've got to see what happens. But we sometimes forget in uber-tolerant Britain that in other parts of the world, national, ethnic and religious divides are still rife. While in the UK, all we seem to care about is the NHS, potholes, whether the bins get emptied, and education, probably in that order. Which is why I was sad to see that in poor schools in poor areas, it was on the news only this week, white kids do worse than other ethnic groups. You put the same kids in better schools and they do very well. But we've got a real issue there with aspiration amongst a lot of our young people in deprived areas, and we've really got to try and do something about it. How we fix that one, answers on a postcard, I think, April.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's never easy, is it?
Now, the biggest news affecting financial markets, in theory, ought to be Iraq, because that's where the oil is. Mm. But they're not a huge producer. But whenever there's a war in the Gulf, the oil price moves up, and it has tacked up a little bit so far in the last couple of weeks. Iraq's not a huge producer, but it impacts on the reserve, so they make a real contribution to the overall price. What's surprising me is at the moment the FTSE is still trading at just over 6.8. But watch that tumble if Baghdad falls. Markets will be very concerned at the rise of a caliphate. Now, I had to look this up this morning, Paul, but do you know what a caliphate is?
I have no idea.
Well, apparently, according to our friends at Wikipedia, a caliphate is an Islamic state led by a supreme religious leader or caliph. Now we know.
Okay.
But there are real issues, and there is a real desire in the Muslim world, and I suppose you can understand it, that they have their own state ruled by Sharia law, and there's moves all over the Middle East to make this happen. So it'll be very interesting and slightly worrying to see what happens over the next few years on that. The real concern is over the role of ISIS. Where's next? One American commentator suggested this morning that Jordan could be next.
Right.
And Jordan's long been a friend of the West. I think the last king was educated in England, and he married an English wife, and his son is now running the place, if I remember rightly. So it could get very interesting. Now, here's a question for you. Where do you think it's cheapest to borrow money in Europe at the moment? The UK, Spain, or Italy? I'll rephrase that. I didn't ask the question right, Paul, before you could chime in. Who do you think it's cheaper for the countries to borrow money for? When they go in the markets and raise money, there was lots of conversations in the markets 6 months ago about the price of money for Spain and Italy.
Right.
It was costing them an absolute fortune.
Right.
I was in Italy only a couple of weeks ago. I thought I'd get that in. Spain's economy is not good. Italy's economy, I can testify, is not good. UK is in huge recovery, doing really well relative to the rest of the world. So who do you think it's cheapest to borrow money for at the moment?
It's obviously going to be counterintuitive, so I'm going to go for Spain.
And you are absolutely right. They're the world's most perverse results at the moment. In the UK, we are having to pay more to borrow money than Spain or Italy, because the markets have just gone absolutely perverse.
Right.
Now, all the commentators are looking at this and saying, lemming mentality, people are silly, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's never going to stay like this. And hopefully it won't. But it is a very, very interesting fact that at the moment Italy and Spain can get their money more cheaply than the UK, and the UK's economy in the grand scheme of things is doing infinitely better.
I don't know what you think about this, and this was one of these pub conversations I had the other day, and I was actually talking to an economist. Now I don't normally do things like that,
but I'm impressed.
Yeah, and one of the problems I have is that with conventional economic thinking and statistical analysis, for a long time, the models used to predict things like that have held fairly true. And I'm beginning to suspect that the original or traditional models of planning economies, economic thinking, aren't exactly how they used to be. And I think it's throwing a wobbly to people in terms of what they're trying to do. And what I mean by that is, exactly as you just said with Spain, if you actually apply a traditional economic model to Spain, it's insane what they're doing. It's just crazy. But they seem to do it anyway. And I'm not sure that you can then build predictions based on erratic behaviour any longer.
Well, I think they call it irrational behaviour.
Yeah.
I mean, their irrational behaviour is extremely erratic. And I think you're absolutely right. Of course, Spain's got a new king. Their king abdicated and his son, I think, was sworn in. Do you swear a king in Spain? I don't know. But he was enthroned earlier this week. I think the truth of the matter is, you've got, was it the Luxembourg finance minister says a couple of years ago, all the politicians know what they need to do in order to fix Europe's broken economies. They just don't know how to get re-elected after they've done it.
Exactly.
And that to some degree feeds the irrationality of some of the movements in politics. Anyway, that's enough of the world markets. Let's look a little closer to home. Interest rates, the housing market, and the future of Ed Miliband, and indeed political correctness associated with Mr. Miliband, seem to dominate the headlines and have certainly struck my interest this week. On the interest rate front, apparently the monetary policy committee, there's a mouthful, the MPC, was unanimous in its decision to keep interest rates unchanged recently, for which we are all eternally grateful if we have mortgages. And I just moved house and I've kept a mortgage. It seemed unbelievably cheap money, so it was sensible to do it, and we have. But the reality of the situation is Carney and his team have to balance rising house prices, which are a real concern and which tend to suggest that rates should go up to somehow cool the market a bit, against the fragile economic recovery, which screams keep rates low, because as soon as you start putting them up, business confidence will be rocked. However, as I said last week, strong national average house price rises disguise the fact that in many places in the UK, house prices are flat. And the last thing they need in those areas, particularly in the north and the Midlands, is some sort of disincentive to buy. There's still much talk about regional price suppressants, especially in London, but they've already made stamp duty on more expensive houses absolutely penal, 5%. And many of the more expensive houses in London change hands for cash. So it's the basic law of supply and demand. People want to buy a house and they'll pay what they need to pay to get it because they think bricks and mortar are going to be secure. What do you think is going to happen to the property market, Paul? That's a good question.
Well, it's interesting. I saw something when you were saying about Carney and interest rates. I'm in a slightly different position to you because I've got savings and no mortgage. So I'm on the other side of the... You know, I think we ought to have 10% as a base rate.
I can't blame you on that one.
But Carney has recently said that he will move interest rates to 0.75%.
Mm.
A lot of people in the financial press started talking about 2015. And he came out with a statement last week saying, who mentioned 2015? Now, the implication of that is, what? Because we don't know whether he meant, no, it's going to be sooner, or no, it's much further out.
Mm.
So that was an interesting statement that you made.
Well, speculating on interest rate movements, I think, is becoming the national preoccupation, at least amongst the chattering classes.
Yeah.
We were saying, as a firm, a couple of years ago, that we weren't going to see rates go up until about 2016. Mm. And I still think we may be right, because there was much talk a couple of weeks ago that rates might just tick up just a little bit to show that Carney was vaguely serious and in control, because it's all about proving that you're prepared to do the necessary. But
the interesting thing, Simon, the interesting thing here, it's what you just said about politics is what's driving a lot of this.
Yeah.
I don't know if I mentioned last week, I am actually on the regional panel of the Bank of England.
All right.
And we have quarterly discussions about such things. And over 18 months ago, the Bank of England signalled that they expected interest rates to hit 2% by 2017. And that was supposed to be a gradual moving thing. But as you just said, the MPC on every single meeting has kept interest rates at zero. And they've continued to do that because they're all terrified of doing anything else. So the Bank of England are never going to hit their target. And that's a political issue as much as anything else. They're never going to get to 2%.
Well, inflation's dipped under 2% now.
It has, yeah, absolutely. I find the whole thing incongruous because I'm an old codger.
Mm-hmm.
And I took my first mortgage out in 1978. And I actually went and looked this up because I thought maybe my memory was playing tricks. But if you go and look on the Bank of England website, they do have historical interest rates going back to the 19th century. And I'm right. In 1978, I took my first mortgage out in April of that year at 8%.
Yeah.
By November of that year, interest rates were 17.6%.
Ouch. Well, that was repeated by me, because when I bought our third house as a couple 26 years ago, no, 25 years ago, interest rates were then something like 5 or 6%. And they were doing all sorts of clever things with deferred interest mortgages, which were encouraging people like me to gear up considerably. Mm. And then base rate went up to 17% or something ridiculous on Black Monday. Mm. I won't tell you what my monthly mortgage payment was, but it felt like the national debt going out of our back pocket every month. It very nearly bankrupted us. And half the country went down.
And anyway, it's really interesting, though, that that used to be the norm. Those huge rises and falls and dips and swings in interest rates were the norm. And then for the last few years, we seem to have been terrified by that and have tried to keep everything low. And, of course, the other thing that I don't think enough people focus on is that the Blair government in 2000 abandoned MIRAS. And I think that was a huge move, and nobody seems to have ever noticed it. If you remember, which was the mortgage interest relief.
At source, yes, indeed.
Yeah. And, I just think, well, that was odd, because they kind of abandoned MIRAS and then started messing around with interest rates ever since.
Yeah, well, MIRAS was actually worth a lot less money by the time it was finally phased out. I remember, I think it was 1988, 1989, I want to say Lamont, it wasn't, it was now works for Barclays Bank, and I can't think of the name of the Chancellor, but Lawson. Who actually allowed banned double Myras, so two single people buying together could actually get two lots of Myras.
Yeah.
And that was worth about 80 or 90 quid a month at the time, and it fed the huge housing bubble,
yeah.
Which then suddenly fell off a cliff when he pulled it out at no notice. He pulled it out and gave people about 2 months' notice, which meant there was this huge bubble, mm-hmm. and then the market fell off a cliff overnight. Anyway, possibly enough on interest rates. The last one, and it's probably a bit sad because you feel almost like you're arriving early at somebody's wake, is the future of Ed Miliband, which is under scrutiny again this week.
Owls.
Well, that's a little side issue, but it probably marks the fact that a party is in a state of some disarray at the moment, and that's a leadership issue. Mm. But when he was first elected, old Ed, I was really quite surprised because I didn't know who the hell he was, and I consider myself moderately well informed. Mm. I knew his brother because he'd been Foreign Secretary, but of course he only got in because of the Union Bloc vote, which was highly democratic, I thought at the time. But and of course my thought, I think with a lot of other people, was they probably elected the wrong brother. Now, while I'm sure that they're both really great chaps, I personally thought that David oozed charm and charisma as Foreign Secretary, while Ed just didn't, and he didn't have the experience either. And so it was hugely ironic to me that one of Ed's notable achievements has been to hugely diminish the power of the unions in future leadership elections, the very people that got him in the first place. Mm. So I don't know why that works, but will he survive? For now, I think so. Mm. But if Labour lose the next election badly, and it's starting to look like that's a real possibility, then I don't think it'll last 5 minutes. Then the question becomes, will Brother Dave come back from self-imposed exile in the US, or will somebody else step forward? But I'm wondering who are the players. So an interesting one. You can have a little tweet on that, moneytalk_guru, if you've got a bet on who's going to be the next Labour leader or whether they're going to be a Labour leader. But perhaps now it's time for some music, so let's see where we go.
Need temporary employment? Call Temp Network on 01892 531 777.
Let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
Was a hot afternoon, the last day of June, and the sun was a demon. The clouds were afraid, one tin in the shade, and the pavement was steaming. I told Billy Ray in his red Chevrolet, needed time for some thinking. I was just walking by when I looked in her eye, and I swore it was winking. She was 31 and I was 17. I knew nothing about love, she knew everything. I sat down beside her on a front porch swing, wondered what the coming night would bring. The sun closed her eyes as it climbed in the skies, and it started to swelter. Sweat trickled down the front of her gown, and I thought it would melt her. She threw back her hair like I wasn't there, and she sipped on a Juliet. Her shoulders were bare, and I tried not to stare when I looked at her too late. When she looked at me, I heard her softly say, I know you're young, you don't know what to do or say, but stay with me until the sun has gone away, and I will chase the boy in you away. Then she smiled, and we talked for a while. Then we walked for a mile to the sea. We sat on the sand, and the boy took her hand. But I saw the sunrise as a man. Have gone by since I looked in her eye, but the memory lingers. I go back in my mind to the very first time I feel the touch of her fingers. Was a hot afternoon, the last day of June, and the sun was a deep. Clouds were afraid, one tin in the shade, and the pavement was steaming.
And as Bobby Goldsborough drifts off into the distance, I reflect on the fact that when you're learning this job, sometimes you push buttons and what you expect is not what actually happens. Absolutely. Why, thanks to producer Paul for digging me out of a hole there. Turning back to matters financial, as we regrouped, one of the most popular questions I'm asked is, what about buy-to-let investment property? Mm-hmm. What about buy-to-let investment property? Well, the UK property market has traditionally been a safe haven for the investor. You can't go wrong with bricks and mortar, as my old mum used to say. Mm-hmm. And it's true. Over the last 50 years, UK property prices have largely risen inexorably upwards, especially in London and the South East, although you can also add Leeds to that list, I suppose. We live on a small island. There isn't a huge amount of spare land for building, and more of us want to own our own homes. But there's a finite supply, and the basic law of economics say that with restricted supply, prices must surely rise. Except in a crash, when they don't. For the longer-term investor, buy-to-let property is certainly an attractive vehicle. I have one or two myself. But the real problem, particularly for older people, is the complexity that this brings to life. Properties need to be managed. You can either do it yourself or pay someone else to do it. If you do it yourself, you have to be fit enough. You have to actually go round and fix the odd tap washer, mend a broken hinge, or put things back on walls that fall off. It's all the stuff you have to do at home, or you get somebody else in to do it. And if you don't do it yourself and you give the job to somebody else, it costs you. And those costs eat into your profits. And they also eat into your life. You've got to actually phone somebody up to fix the boiler. It's that famous advert from one of the gas companies. Do you want to get the phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, my boiler's been on the blink? In truth, I don't think I've ever had a call at 3 o'clock in the morning about the boiler or anything else come to that. But it must be a worry. But then the other thing that really eats into your profits is mortgage interest. Right. If you have to borrow to buy a house, then mortgage interest is going to be probably your largest single cost. Now, you can still get interest-only buy-to-let mortgages, but one of the things to bear in mind is under the new mortgage regulations, in fact, it's always been quite difficult to get mortgages beyond the age of 70 or 75. So if you're looking to do a buy-to-let thing and you're in your late 60s or even early 60s, then you've got a time-limited investment there, and it's not so easy to hand on. So it wouldn't be very long for you then, Paul.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not something I have at the moment either, actually, but...
It is a concern, because if you need to borrow money to buy your buy-to-lets and interest rates rise sharply, as they have done in recent memory, then that wipes out your profit. And in fact, it may even cost you to own your investment property. Mm. And that can be a real issue, because you've got to ask yourself, is it worth the hassle? Because there is this hassle involved in owning a buy-to-let property. You have to collect the rent. You have to deal with the properties we've already said. You have to deal with tenant problems. You have to find a perishing tenant. And then you get that awkward phone call. You've also got to deal with rent arrears, deal with any void periods. You've got a gap between tenants moving in and moving out, and all the changeovers and what, looking at your inventory and just the simple maintenance of the property and the garden generally.
And presumably, when you cash out and sell the property, you've got capital gains tax to pay on it as well.
Correct. We were talking about this off air, weren't we, Paul? Mm. It is an issue. People forget about this. If you buy a house for £200,000 and you sell it for £200,000 and you live in it, you keep all the profit, which is fantastic because there's a main residence exemption. So if it's your own house and it is your deemed main residence, i.e. it's the one that you and the Inland Revenue have agreed is going to be your house, and if you only own one house, it's very straightforward, it's the one you live in.
Yeah.
But if you own more than one, you can tell the revenue which one they want to deem as your main residence. And in this sort of term, terminology, deem means let's pretend. So we're going to pretend that this house is your main residence, and there are some things you can do about deeming your main residence to be one or other of your buy-to-lets for a couple of years before you sell it that may help with your tax bill, but it doesn't alter the fact that capital gains will really eat into your profits. The real advantage with buy-to-let is the straightforward geared return that you can get.
Right.
If you've got, let's say, £100,000 and you put that on deposit at 5%, you will get £5,000 as a return.
Right.
Dead straightforward, nice and easy. If you put that same £100,000 into a buy-to-let property, let's pretend it costs you £200,000, and that property goes up 5%, you've made £10,000. So your investment has effectively doubled its return due to the leverage that you've got from the borrowing that you've put into your buy-to-let. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yep.
So it's really very interesting, and it's a prime motivator for people when they look at the buy-to-let market, but they often forget all the hassle that goes with it. And I often speak to a lot of older people who are thinking, well, everybody else has got a buy-to-let property, maybe I should have one as well. And you go, well, look, my darling, you're 70 years of age. Do you really want to be going up and seeing some burly student and saying, where's my rent for the month?
Yeah, and turn the music down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be a real issue. So a lot of people who reach their 50s and 60s are trying to find new ways of simplifying their lives. I'd love to simplify mine because there's just so much stuff going on. And you go, oh, I've got to manage this house and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And it just drives you all the nuts. So the short answer is, if you're young and fit and you don't mind a bit of hassle, or even if you're older and fit and you don't mind a bit of hassle, buy-to-let can be a great investment, but you've just got to watch for all these potential pitfalls. Now, I've got a couple of personal warnings on this one, which are, be very careful when you buy flats as buy-to-let investments, because they can sometimes be difficult to unload. Getting rid of a flat where there's a lot of buy-to-let properties can be very difficult. There's a number of people I know have been caught by this.
Right.
So look for a house. And the other thing is, use the same sort of sliding scale of things that you want for a property that you would use when you were buying the house for yourself to live in. Even if it's a smaller house than you live in yourself, go and look and say, are we reasonably close to the shops? Are we reasonably close to the station? Are we reasonably close to the amenities and the schools? Are we reasonably close to the universities if we're looking at student accommodation or whatever? So that you've actually looked at the property as somebody who might buy it from you at some stage in the future. I think a lot of people just go out and say, well, I'm going to buy a buy-to-let property. Oh, that one's the right money. I'll buy that. I'm not going to live in it. I don't care.
Yeah.
Which is great right up until the time when you try and sell it, because then people may be a little bit more discerning and say, well, that property hasn't got this and it hasn't got that, and you won't get the capital return. So one of the things my wife is very good at, and bless you, Pam, for this, is that she insists that we only buy houses that we'd be prepared to live in ourselves, so that when we come to sell them, there'll be some chance that somebody else is going to buy it.
Right.
So we've avoided making some horrible mistakes in the buy-to-let investment market, because I've just sort of gone, well, let's go and buy a house. It doesn't matter what it is. We're not going to live there. But if you do that, it's a real no-no. And so I would strongly, strongly, strongly advise against that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? In line with some of the other things you were saying earlier and the things we were discussing, the problem is, with interest rates being the way they are and people getting virtually nil return on their savings, there's been this vogue to try and invest in property because it's one of the few things that you can own that you understand, you know, because most people don't understand equities and things like that. It's one of the few things that you can understand and actually makes you a return on your investment. So it's become a very voguish thing to do because there isn't anywhere else to put your money at the moment.
Well, there's certainly a lot of people think that way. But the reality of the situation is owning a property is just as complicated as owning stocks and shares. Absolutely. It's just that there are different sorts of complexities. Yeah. And as with so many of these things, it's only when you actually do it for the first or second time, a bit like doing a radio show, that you start to realise that the people who actually do this professionally do it for a living and they've got lots of experience. Whereas when you're doing it yourself, everything you do is something you're doing for the first time. And you go, how do I do this? What's the best way of doing it? Am I losing money? Am I instructing the right plumber or the right gas fitter? And are they going to tow up on time? Do I have to take time off work to actually let them in and do all this other stuff? So there's all sorts of issues. However, I've given a load of warnings because financial advisors do that. But the reality of the situation is buy-to-let property is still a very attractive investment. And we would still encourage those of the right people who've thought it through and are confident that they're going to be able to manage it or get somebody else to manage it for them at a price that's worthwhile to have a look at it. Because that leveraged investment, that geared return that you can get where you can get 10 grand off your 100 grand rather than 5 grand off your 100 grand is the real driver for a lot of people. And if you can get the right property with the right sort of rental income, it can be a hugely attractive investment. So we'll finish on a positive note with that. One. I had some questions, Paul. I've had some questions on Facebook. So a hello to Corinne Downs, who asks, what happens to the money of people who die without family or will? Does the state claim it? And what do they do with it? What about unclaimed prize monies like premium bonds? Where does that go? And how long are they obliged to keep it?
Right, okay, that's a good question.
Well, it's a very good question. And the answer is actually quite surprising. The first thing is, if you've got any stuff, make a will. If you don't, then what happens to your stuff is determined by law. And there are a set of rules, and we'll come to in a second, that determine what happened to your stuff. So if you want the state to decide what happened to your things when you're dead, then just do nothing and you'll be fine. In every other circumstance, make a will. And it's a simple thing to do. You can actually buy online will kits for about 25 quid, and every solicitor in the land is now screaming, no, don't talk to a lawyer and do it properly. And I would agree. Go and see a solicitor. It'll cost you under 100 quid to make a basic will, and then you know that whatever you've decided is what's going to happen to your stuff.
Can I ask you a question? I don't know if you know the answer to this. I know you're not a lawyer, but somebody actually asked me this the other day, and I didn't know. If you do buy one of those do-it-yourself will kits and, you know, you fill it in and you get it witnessed and stuff like that, what do you do with it then? How does anyone know that you've done that?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's a popular sort of, oh my gosh, where are all the paperwork? What tends to happen as people get older is they actually say to their kids, right, I've got all my affairs vaguely sorted out, and here is a box, or here is the safe, and this is the combination for the safe at home, or here is the deposit box at the bank, or whatever, and it's lodged like that. Now, you can get professional custodian companies, a lot of them are lawyers, actually, who will look after your private papers. The bank will give you got a custodian service. Most of the banks operate one. Or you can get I want to call it a deposit box, but it's not. What do you have? A box at the bank.
A safety deposit box
at the bank. You can keep your stuff in there. Or you could just have a drawer in the cupboard at home. And as long as you haven't got a fire, it's not a problem. But what you normally have to do is tell your kids where your stuff is. Yeah. And that's really important. Or tell your executor. One of the things you can do is, one of the things you do with a will is you actually appoint somebody to manage your affairs after you're dead.
Right.
And so you would appoint your best mate or a lawyer or financial advisor or your accountant or somebody professional, somebody that you trust and know. It could just be a good mate to look after your stuff and make sure it goes where you want it to. So you would give a copy of your will to your executor or tell your executor where it is. Right. Quite often, if you've got kids, it'll be one of your kids that is your executor, and that would be how it is okay. Sorted. The other thing, of course, you can do is you can just put a copy online telling people where it is. There's all sorts of options to do it. We've actually got a little facility on our corporate website now, which is a client portal where clients can upload their own documents to a website. Now, scanned documents don't have the same legal validity as a real document with a wet signature in it, so you still need the original document to be on the safe side, but you can put a list of all your important contacts and all your important paper into these things, and there's several companies that do it. But if you want to use ours, go to www.FFF.com tfp.co.uk and fill in the contact form, and we'll send you some information on it. So if you die without making any sort of will and you've got no family, which goes back to Corinne's original question, then yes, the state does get your money. It's really that straightforward. Now, there's a very precise order of priorities. So if you die leaving a wife or civil partner and children, and your net estate, the total value of your stuff, less any debt on your estate, is worth less than £250,000, it all goes to your spouse or civil partner if she or he survives the deceased by 28 days. Right. So you've got to wait a month, and then it's all yours if it's worth less than 250,000 quid. But if you live in the southeast and you've got a house and some stuff, it's going to be worth more than 250,000 quid. There's a very strong chance. If you've got a net estate of over £250,000, the first 250 plus your personal stuff, sometimes referred to in the legal world as chattels, goes directly to your spouse or civil partner. The first 250 to your spouse or civil partner, and half of the rest is shared equally amongst the children. The spouse or civil partner then gets a right to the interest or the income for the other half during their lifetime, and then that second half, over the 250, goes to the children in equal shares. And there's a great long table that I could read, but I think we might actually tax the patience of our listeners if I go through it. But they've recently introduced a new band at £450,000, but it walks down the thing. If you've got children but no spouse or civil partner, it goes to the children in equal shares on reaching 18. If you've got neither spouse nor civil partner nor children, it goes to your parents in equal shares, but there's a good chance that your parents will predecease you. But right at the end, if you've got no spouse, no civil partner, and no blood relatives, all the estate goes to the Crown, which is effectively another way of saying the government gets it, and it just becomes part of general taxation. And there's quite a big number that ends up with the Crown at the each year, where people have not made a will and they don't have any relatives. So it's really a very good idea to do it. It's also a good idea, if you want to make some sort of bequest in your will to charity or to your to a political party, because that has very good results for tax planning. But that's probably a subject for another day. Following on from Corinne's question, she also asks, I've got to get the exact wording right, so I'm going to flick to another page to make sure that I read the right bit, but what happens if with unclaimed prize money on premium bonds, and where does that money go? And I have the answer to that question as well. It's interesting, actually, that premium bonds are run by NSI, National Savings and Investment. It used to be just called National Savings, now National Savings and Investment. And they actually try and trace you for nearly forever. And they're actually running a huge campaign at the moment, trying to trace people who've moved house. I mean, it's very interesting. We just moved house, as I think I mentioned last week. And we found a premium bond certificate with my name that I'd forgotten I had. It's only worth about 30 quid or something. It's nothing very exciting. But I got it from my mum when she died. It's now in my name. And I've got no idea whether I've got any prize money. I've never bothered to look, but the NSI keep a record, and they say they've got over £44 million unclaimed premium bond prizes, and they've got 898,000 unclaimed prizes, of which the largest is 100,000 quid.
I can answer that question.
Go on then.
Because I've recently gone through this. My old mum found a premium bond that she took out, or my grandmother took out, on the day I was born. Okay, which was a long time ago.
So it was a very, very old piece of paper.
It was a very old piece of paper, and it was a £1 premium bond.
Oh, goodness me.
So I rang NSI, and I said, I found this. I just want to check whether I've got any winnings from this. And they went, what is it? And I said, it's a £1 bond. And they said, we can tell you now without looking. The answer's no. And I went, really? And they said, yes, because for bonds of that denomination, which were very popular back then, the chances of getting a win on that are like 17 trillion to one.
Oh,
because they've got an algorithm for doing
this. It's worse than the National Lottery, then.
Exactly. And they said, we will look it up, but we can almost absolutely guarantee you've got nothing over all of those years. Thank you for that.
Well, there you go. Well, it's funny. But then the other part of Corinne's question is, how long do other organisations try and trace you? So that made me do a bit of research, because I didn't know the answer. But, of course, private lotteries, and in fact, just about any lottery or prize fund, is governed by the contract or the terms and conditions of the particular offering that you subscribe to. So, for example, the National Lottery, which is probably the largest one of all, only hold your money for up to 180 days. Mm. So if you lose your ticket and find it on day 181, your money has gone to the good causes. So effectively, the National Lottery Company reinvests the money of unclaimed prizes into the good causes that it's supposed to fund. Yeah. If you want to know what happens to other specific things, then I'm afraid you've just got to read the terms and conditions, the T's and C's of whoever it is that you're looking to do some business with. So we've dealt with intestacy, and we've dealt with what happens to prize money, and I think it's probably time for another song.
Jobsinkent.com.
But for some reason, my music machine is not working properly, so...
Channelradio.co.uk.
Perfect.
channelradio.co.uk.
Welcome back to Money Talk. This is Simon Webster. Just a quick plug for our Twitter account. I think we've got so far seven tweets and about 14 followers. So we would love for people to follow it. If you can look us up, it's Money Talk_Guru. And we're going to be building a website which is going to be moneytalk.co.uk. No, moneytalk.guru. And we're going to be building some traffic on the moneytalk_guru Twitter handle. I'll get there in the end. This technology just drives me nuts with all the underscores and all the endings and everything else. Yeah. It was so much easier when it was just .co.uk. But moving on. Last week we looked at retirement and I concluded, and I think we all concluded, that we're all living a bit longer, which is great. That the state is broken, that probably isn't going to change, which is sad, but a fact. That inflation is a menace, and lastly, that we need to own the problem ourselves and put money away from as young an age as possible if we're not going to be broke when we retire. Now, when you get to the other end, when you actually get to retirement, you've built up this bucket full of £50 notes. How do you get your hands on the money? Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Well, up until recently, you used to be able to take some money out as tax-free cash, and then you had to buy an annuity. And when I start talking about annuities, I just see the eyes of the world glaze over and people start to yawn. Because most people think, probably rightly now, that annuities are a bit of a rip-off. Now, they didn't used to think that. In the 1980s, a single male aged 65 could get an annuity income of about 12%, which meant if you had a pension pot of 100,000 quid, you could get 12,000 a year for the rest of your life. Now, people always hated the fact that if they died the day after retirement, the pension company kept the rest of the money as a windfall profit. And you had to live effectively 8 years even then to get all your money back. But the reality of the situation was if you lived to 100, the insurance company still had to pay 12,000 a year every year. So it was a bit of a lottery. But the lottery has got worse because for a single male aged 65 today, the best sort of income you're going to get is something in the region of £4,914, which is nearer 5%. So if you were lucky enough by an accident of birth to retire 30 years ago, you would be three times better off nearly than somebody who was retiring today who had been just as diligent in their retirement savings, which is why the budget was such a huge benefit to people when they came to retire. We'll get onto that a little bit later, because when I first joined the financial services industry, I was taught about something called the four steps to unhappiness, and I'm now going to really cheer up all the people that are shortly going to retire. And I can see Paul's face, and he's just getting sadder and sadder and sadder, because he's quite close really. Yep. But when you get to retirement, you need to pick a shape that your income is going to be. Now, what I mean by a shape is, are you married? Do you have a civil partner? Do you want that person to get some income out of your pension if you die before them? If they die before you and you've elected to give them some sort of income, then you've given up some income yourself in order that they can get something that they're not there to get. So that's a bit unfair, but that's the way it works. And then you've got to ask yourself, well, what happens if I die the day after retirement? The insurance company keep all that money. That's not very nice. And then you've got to worry about inflation, and you've got to build in a whole pile of different things. And the four steps to unhappiness work like this. Let's pretend you start with a pension pot of £125,000 or thereabouts. I tried to think of the number quickly and I got it slightly wrong, but let's pretend a quarter of that is the first 25,000 quid. So you take your tax-free cash out and immediately your potential income has just gone down by 25%. So that's the first step to unhappiness, a huge 25% drop in your income. Now, of course, you can take that £25,000, invest it, and that's going to provide some income. And the advantage with that money is it's now in your estate and able to be distributed in accordance with your will. So it does mean if you do die the day after you retire, please God it won't happen, that at least your family gets the 25 grand, which is really helpful. But then what you really need to know is what the inflation rate's going to be, when you're going to die, and when your wife's going to die, in order to choose the best possible shape of annuity that you can have. But the problem is, we don't know that. Have you got a crystal ball, Paul?
No, I haven't.
No, well, there have been some rumours circulating about this one. Penny's looking in from the outside, and but we're not going to go there. Yes, big smile. We're not going to say anything else. I shall get in trouble with the broadcasters. But if you start off with a single life annuity of £4,914, that's no inflation, no dependents pension, no escalation, then what you might do is you might say, well, I would like that pension paid for a minimum of 10 years, irrespective of how long I actually live. Now, that's a really good thing to do because it's actually dirt cheap. Your initial income drops from 4,900 to 4,788, which is only a couple of hundred quid a year, but it does mean if you die the day after you retire, then your estate will receive that 4,788 each year for 10 years. So at least you get a large chunk of your money back. So that's a really positive thing to do and worth looking at. But the really expensive one is if you decide that you want to have inflation built in. Now, we all know that we're living longer. It was one of the findings that we talked about last week. So if we only have 2 or 3% inflation over 20 or 30 years, that's going to make a hell of a difference. And as a result of that, the initial money that the insurance companies will pay when you buy an annuity drops down still further to £3,518. So you've got the same £100,000 pot, but your day one income is £3,518. Now, the problem with that is year one, you get £3,518. Year two, you get £3,518 plus 3%, and I haven't got a slide rule, but we have got a little program in the office where we can work out how long it takes before you get to the level pension you would have had if you'd have selected the 4,900 at the beginning. And it can be quite a few years. So you end up in a situation where you've done the right thing, you plan for inflation, but if you die early, you've taken this huge income hit to no real advantage. And then the last thing you can do is you can build in a widow's pension or a survivor's pension. Typically it's 50%. You can actually have anything between 0 and 100, although not a lot of people go for the 100% because it's so blooming expensive. And that would take you down to about 3-1. So by the time you finish, these four steps of unhappiness can take you from an initial income of £4,900 down to an income of £3,178. And you need to know this information that is unknowable before you start. How long am I going to live? How long is my wife going to live? What's the rate of inflation going to be? And if you don't know the answer to these questions, the only thing you can do is guess. And guessing is a nightmare. So it's a real issue, and we spend a lot of time with our clients trying to help them work out what is going to be best for them going forward. Chancellor was very helpful in his budget, and he made a whole series of changes to the way pension income could be taken when he stood up last month. Was it last month? I lose track. No, it was a couple of months ago. It was in March. It was March. We've had for a while now the facility to take something called pension income drawdown, and it used to come in two flavours: cap drawdown and flexible drawdown. But basically speaking, the idea was that you had your same pot of £100,000, and you could actually leave that pot of money invested, and then try and take the income that £100,000, or try and take the investment return that £100,000 generated as your pension income. Now, that has the huge advantage that, of course, you keep your £100,000 intact, which is a nice thing because you're not handing it over to an insurance company the day that you retire. But it leaves you open to the vagaries of the investment market. So if investment markets halve and you're invested in those same markets, your £100,000 drops down to 50,000 quid and you could be out of pension very, very fast. So this is not something for the faint-hearted or for people who think that investment markets are going to drop. Now, I could do a long technical treatise on the difference between flexible drawdown and cap drawdown, but I'm not going to. And a lot of people, including Paul, breathe a huge sigh of relief. But the basic rule was the government actuaries department set a rate, referred to in the trade as the GAD rate. And that was, broadly speaking, a rate equivalent to the single life annuity that we could get in the open market. So give or take 5%. And the GAD rate was, let's pretend, 5%. So if you had a £100,000 pot under drawdown, if you were just taking 100% of GAD, you could take 5%. What they said was you could take 120% of GAD. Then the budget came along and now says you can take 150% of GAD, which is equivalent to a 7.5% annuity rate. Now, if you take the 7.5% and you only get a 5% investment return, then obviously you are running down the value of the capital in your pension fund. But on the grounds that it'll probably still last 25 years at that sort of rate, and you're probably only going to live 25 years, you should be okay. But it still becomes a bit of a lottery. But the really interesting thing that the Chancellor did in the budget was he said that drawdown was not... people weren't going to have to buy an annuity when they were 75, and anybody could effectively do pension income drawdown, but they were not going to be caught by this GAD rate restriction. They could take as much out of their pension pot as they wanted. And all the commentators rushed out and said, well, this is blooming marvellous. Everybody's going to have built up a £500,000 pension fund or a £200,000 pension fund, and they'll go out and buy themselves Bugatti Veyrons with their pension fund the day of retirement. Now, it ain't going to happen like that. And the reason it isn't going to happen is only 25% of your pension pot comes out tax-free. The rest is taxable at the highest rate that you pay tax. So if you are in a situation where you've got a £100,000 pension pot and you take the whole thing out in one hit, and that's after your 25% tax-free cash, and you have the standard level of personal allowance, then you're going to pay tax on about 60,000 quid at 40%. And you don't need to. All you need to do is wait till the next tax year and take the next load of money out up to the maximum that you pay basic rate tax on, and you've saved 20% income tax. So even if you wanted to clean your pension fund out completely as quickly as possible, people are still going to face it. But in point of fact, for a government on the back foot financially, I think the Chancellor was incredibly clever. Because in reality, what he's just done is he said from next year, people can take their money out of pensions and they can take it out in a hurry. And if you do, what happens? You pay tax. What does the government need at the moment? Some tax revenues. So in point of fact, he's actually killed two birds with one stone. With one stone, he's actually freed up the pension market and he's removed the number one obstacle to a lot of people saving for retirement, which is I no longer have to buy an annuity and give a large chunk of my money to an insurance company as a windfall profit if I die early. I no longer have to wait nearly 20 years to get my money back with a 5% annuity rate. And people were saying, well, that's just not fair, or I don't like it. But now you can get all your money out very early on into your retirement, depending on the size of your fund, and only pay basic rate tax on 75% of the money and get the rest out tax-free with 25% of the money. Now, whichever way you look at it, that is a huge, huge win. And everybody should be queuing up to buy their pensions now. Has it motivated you, Paul?
It has. Funnily enough, I'm in a slightly different situation because I am technically in drawdown.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Although I don't take any money.
But it was a handy way of getting some cash in a hurry.
It was indeed, yeah. So I'm there, and I happen to know what my GAB rate is and all the rest of it as well. I think you're absolutely right, and I absolutely agree with what you said about that. It was a clever move from the Chancellor on both sides of the equation. It has freed up the market. It has given us more options. If people do the silly thing and take it, then the Treasury is going to succeed by having half the money from you.
And everybody wins, because that means there's more money to pay benefits, more money to fund the NHS, more money to fund education, and that's got to be very good news all round.
Absolutely.
So we're running down to the last 30 seconds of the show, but the message is it is now more flexible to get your money out of a pension than ever before. Mm-hmm. And what that means in practice is when your employer says to you, do you want to be auto-enrolled? And in fact, he doesn't ask you, he just auto-enrolls you, which is going to be the subject of a future show. You say, oh, yes, please, because I'm going to have some money from you, some money from the taxman, some money from me, and I'm going to end up with a huge pot that I can then take a large chunk of money out of, pretty well tax-free or at marginal rate tax, and I'm ahead of the game because it's going to be the best thing you can possibly do with your money. So that's Simon Webster signing off for Money Talk for another show. I look forward to speaking to you same time next week. Goodbye. Have a great week.
Goodbye. It worked, that's fine.